Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 361. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you today. We have a tremendous guest on the program with us. And again, you might wonder how we could possibly follow up what happened with our last guest. Five-time now lounge guest Bob Barker coming on to talk about his most recent appearance on The Price is Right last week, his 90th birthday. That was really tremendous. But again, we are keeping the momentum going full steam today. I'm very excited to welcome back to the program this gentleman. He has been on the show previously. We had him on in February of 2012. We're having him on today to talk about the college football bowl season as he covers college football, among other things, for ESPN and for ABC. We'll also delve a little bit into fantasy football. We've got the playoffs, most leagues championships coming up this weekend for a few unfortunate souls like myself in 17-week leagues. It's only the semifinals, but for most people, this is the championship this weekend. And we'll touch a little bit on the end here. We talked to him previously when he was on the program. He is a well-known enthusiast of the pro graps, and as we confirmed last time around, that meant that, as I suspected, he grew up on the Bill Watts product. Just finally had the long-awaited Watts official DVD release from the WWE recently. We'll have to get some thoughts from him on that towards the end as well. But we're very, very happy and pleased to welcome back to the show Robert Flores of ESPN and ABC. Robert, welcome back to the FDH Lounge. Sir, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, doing fine, thanks. Very glad to get to talk to you here with the bowl season coming up, the excitement that is starting this weekend. I happened to be at the Big Ten Championship game a couple weeks ago and got to see, unfortunately from my perspective, Ohio State fold up like a paper airplane, essentially, in that game. That was really kind of unfortunate for anyone that thought that they were going to have a chance to go all the way in year two of Urban Meyer. But what were you thinking as it was leading up to this? It was seeming very improbable in the weeks coming up here that we would have this sort of clean 1-2 matchup with Florida State and Auburn, but it's clearly uncontested. There's nobody else that could make a strong bid for being there. Did you have a sense it would work out as it has seemed to so many times in recent years, or did you think this year would be the exception and we'd have three, maybe four teams knocking on that door?
Well, I was hoping that we would have three and four teams that would have a legitimate claim to playing in the national title game. I'm not a big fan of the BCS. I'm glad that it's over. I think it's silly to have computers and, you know, polls and strength of schedule. I just prefer that we have what we're going to have next season. It's a playoff. Granted, it's only four teams, and that fifth and sixth team, they will be complaining that they are left out, but I think eventually you'll see it grow to eight. But I was surprised that Ohio State didn't end up closing out Michigan State. I knew that Michigan State would be their best opponent that they have played all season. But I didn't. I just thought that Ohio State would find a way to make enough plays, and clearly they didn't. And Michigan State's offense was a little bit more explosive than I thought that they would be. And congrats to them. They ended up winning, and they're going to the Rose Bowl.
They are going. They probably would have been going one way or another, but the way that it shook out, they go with the automatic Big Ten bid. And again, part of the reason Michigan State's offense looked as good as it did was a very, very lackluster performance by the Ohio State defense. And I can tell you from being there in the crowd that night, Robert, a lot of people in scarlet and gray just shaking their heads at what happened. But couldn't have been too big of a surprise after the Michigan game the previous week. But yeah, Ohio State, of course, that means that they're not going to get a chance to get obliterated by Florida State, because if you can't stop Michigan State, you got no hope for stopping the Seminoles. What do you think when you check out that team, Robert? This is one of these things where in the last couple of years, I personally have touted Florida State only to see them fall apart at one point or another. Is it all Jameis Winston this year that basically made them too good to stumble at any point in time along the way, or is there more to the story than that?
Well, I think it's, you know, Jameis Winston certainly deserves a tremendous amount of credit, but Jimbo Fisher and his coaching staff, especially on the offensive side of the ball, I think they deserve the most credit because when you look at Jameis Winston play, he is fundamentally sound. His mechanics are pretty good. Obviously, there's always room for improvement, but he's still a very young player. But he is he's so good with his mechanics, and you can just tell he has received some good coaching in his two seasons there at in Tallahassee. Obviously, last year he was a redshirt freshman. But I just think that they have so much talent on the offensive side of the ball. Defensively, they're good. It's just, you know, up and down their roster, they're just blessed with talent. But I think Jimbo Fisher has done a tremendous job and should get most of the credit, for, as well as his coaching staff.
Well, Fisher has really kind of transformed this Florida State team into what was expected really the last couple of years. And, again, we're reaching the heights that they did when Bobby Bowden was there. It will be a heck of a national championship game. January 6th, of course, on ESPN, 8:30 Eastern time. Again, 13-0 Florida State, 12-1 Auburn. As you look at the other BCS bowl games this year, Robert, of course, the Orange Bowl, 10-2 Clemson versus 12-1 Ohio State. The Sugar Bowl, Alabama 11-1 versus Oklahoma 10-2. The Fiesta Bowl, kind of a strange one here. Baylor 11-1 versus UCF 11-1. They've got some trouble selling tickets to that game thus far, was my understanding. And the Rose Bowl, the granddaddy of them all, Michigan State 12-1 versus Stanford 11-2. Is there one of these games that has you a little bit more excited or intrigued than the other one? What are your thoughts on looking at the rest of the BCS bowls, Robert?
Well, aside from the national championship, I think the game that I'm most looking forward to is the Baylor Central Florida game. And the reason is I lived in Waco and covered Baylor for 6 years in the mid 90s. So that was a program. It was among the worst programs in that were in major conferences. I mean, it was about as bad can be. And to see them where they're at now and to see the job that Art Briles has done, it's remarkable. I would have never imagined, because I was, like I said, I covered them for 6 years and then four more years after that when I was in Austin. And they were just a horrible program. And I'm really happy for those fans and those people. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how they play against Central Florida. The Golden Knights under George O'Leary are a good program as well in the American Athletic Conference. And Blake Bortles is a quarterback that can put up some numbers. So I expect this game to be very high scoring.
Absolutely, yeah. It could be like a video game there, watching those teams go back and forth. And, yeah, you are absolutely right. America is going to get to learn a lot about both of these programs here and the great job that Art Briles has done. It'll be the national spotlight like that program really hasn't seen before in one game. Of course, RG3 being there was pretty big, but to see them in a BCS game is going to be huge. Of course, going down the slate, looking at some of the other bowl games this year, you got some really interesting subplots. Mack Brown kind of fittingly closing it out at the Alamo, but he's got Oregon waiting him for him there. That's going to be interesting. Miami and Louisville in the Russell Athletic Bowl, that's maybe a better combination than you would have expected that game to get when you look at some of the talent on the field. Notre Dame in the Pinstripe Bowl is going to be a real story. Somehow or another, the Cotton Bowl the last couple of years has gotten to scrounge up some pretty nice matchups. You got Oklahoma State and Missouri. What are your thoughts on some of the other bowl games? What are the things you're looking forward the most to seeing as you go down the slate in the quote-unquote other bowls?
Well, you mentioned the Alamo Bowl, and you know, I also worked in Austin for 4 years, and I got to know Mack Brown a little bit. He was... you could not have asked for – he's just a genuinely nice guy, and he's an outstanding coach, and he did – what he did for that program will always be remembered, winning a national title and having so many successful seasons. But obviously, you know, good things must come to an end, and it was time for him to leave. So I'm eager to see how his team responds to the circumstances, knowing that this is his final game. You mentioned the Cotton Bowl. I think that's going to be an interesting matchup between Missouri and Oklahoma State. So a couple of the former Big 12 teams that know each other very well. So there's definitely a lot of other games aside from the BCS that you know will be interesting and make for some good theater.
Absolutely, and I could have been a homer and asked you about Ohio playing in the Beef O'Brady's Bowl, but I'm not under any illusions that that's anybody's point of great interest unless they are a Bobcat. But you know, there are stories up and down the line here. In terms of looking ahead to the future, which we kind of touched on a little bit, the new setup with the BCS next year being replaced by the four-game playoff, there's a theory that we have in-house here that I want to run by you. Our FDH Director of Research, Nate Noy, has posited to me, and I think there's a very good case to be made by this, that you're going to see maybe disproportionately in the years ahead the number two team in the SEC West represented in that Final Four there, that whether it be maybe the loser of, say, the Alabama-LSU game or whatever, a team not having to go to the SEC championship game and risk a loss. We saw that a couple of years ago where Alabama actually managed to get into the national championship game itself as the number two team in the SEC West. So do you see with the strength out there that happening a number of times possibly if the team only has one loss, if they lose to the eventual conference champion, that they too will be represented in that Final Four?
Well, I think that theory, that's a sound one. And it sounds like, I mean, on its face, it sounds like something that could definitely happen. But I think what you're going to see is you're going to see that SEC champion get a spot, a Pac-12 champion get a spot, a Big Ten champion. You know, these are going to go to major conferences. Believe me, unfortunately, we're not going to see, Boise State, or we're not going to see that. Unfortunately, I wish we would, because I think that makes one of the great things about sports. But this is going to be big boy conferences getting these spots, and that's why I'm in favor of just those major conferences just kind of breaking away from the rest of college football and just having their own division, and let everyone else have their own division as well. So I think you're going to see those spots go to the major conferences. But, yeah, that team that does not get into the SEC title game, it wouldn't shock me if they somehow get one of those four spots.
Absolutely, and they're not risking a loss in the SEC championship game because they're not even eligible to play in it. So, yeah, that we'll have to see in the years to come how that plays out. And speaking of looking ahead to the years to come, as a partial segue here between the bowls that we're going to be looking at here in the next couple weeks and talking about fantasy football, what are your thoughts on some of the skill position players that we're going to be seeing in these bowls here getting spotlighted? When you look at wide receivers such as Lee at USC or Watkins at Clemson, are there any guys in particular you think that are future fantasy studs that are really going to be spotlighted in this year's bowl season?
Well, I mentioned the Florida State the Fiesta Bowl matchup between Baylor and Central Florida. I think you've got kind of two quarterbacks that are really outstanding in Bryce Petty and Blake Bortles. Two guys that Petty certainly got a lot of, and he was in some Heisman consideration there, but those are two guys that don't come to mind to the casual college football fan. I'm interested to see how those guys fare. You mentioned Lee, the wide receiver for USC. I think that's a guy. He's definitely going to be playing on Sunday. And Florida State, look, they have so many players and so many skill position players all over, not only in the offensive side but also on defense that you'll also be seeing on Sunday. So those type of players come to mind as far as guys that have NFL futures.
Absolutely. All of those sound very viable to me as well. And in terms of fantasy football, in terms of lessons to kind of take away, I mean, we're still finishing up the 2013 season, but it's never too early to think ahead. When you look at the running backs this year in particular, unless you really had one of the top guys, McCoy or Forte or Charles or Morris or Lynch. I almost hesitate to put AP in there because for the guys playing in the semifinals last week, they got a big goose egg from him. But unless you had one of those guys, do you think people are going to be coming to the conclusion that it may make more sense to take a wide receiver, maybe even later in the first round next year, but to go for a wide receiver instead of necessarily being chained to the idea of you got to get your number one running back in the first round? I mean, I have long kind of fought that idea myself, but I know a lot of people still believed that. Do you think this season did anything to undermine that thought?
Well, I think it also depends on the size of your league. If you are in a 10-team league, I think the after what we saw this year, I mean, unless you're getting Jamaal Charles or Shady McCoy, I would say get Peyton Manning. You know, that would have been the wise strategy for this year. You know, get Peyton Manning as your first pick. And usually, in some of our pre-draft shows, we had, we said to get a running back first, and then there's so much depth at quarterback, which to a certain extent it's true. But if you get Peyton Manning, if you got Peyton Manning with the first pick, your first pick, I mean, he's by far and away the guy scoring the most points more often than not. So I think to your point, it is true to a certain extent that I think we are seeing, unless you are getting McCoy and Charles, because look at Arian Foster. He was another guy that did not perform well, and he was picked number two overall in a lot of drafts. So I think that maybe we are seeing kind of a change in the philosophy of running backs and where they fit in fantasy drafts and fantasy teams, because part of it is teams just throw it so much, you know, and I think the way the games are played on the field is obviously having an impact in how you construct your fantasy team as well.
Oh, absolutely. That is really driving it when you look at the process of the league and how teams are trying to extract their offense. What I'm curious about as well, you referenced quarterback depth there, and that kind of made my ears perk up because with our sister division of FantasyDraftHelp.com, we had it this year where we drew a line underneath that top tier of, you mentioned Peyton Manning, but Manning, Rodgers, who unfortunately that was kind of a fluke thing, snapping the collarbone, and Drew Brees. Do you see a thing going into next year where you're looking at a top tier, in your estimation, that will be similarly kind of shallow because you can get guys later on? I mean, you can get a Matt Stafford later on to give you a whole boatload of yards and touchdowns and everything. Do you think that the depth of the position is going to be similar in terms of next year's view?
Yeah, I think it'll be similar. I mean, look, Peyton Manning is going to still be highly regarded. Same for Aaron Rodgers. I think Tom Brady is an interesting situation because he is so impacted, and rightly so, by the weapons around him. It has just been kind of a revolving door. Not having Gronkowski certainly affects him. Drew Brees is always going to be a guy that puts up points. I think we have to see what happens with Nick Foles. I mean, maybe he's a guy that if he's not in right in that first tier, maybe he is in that tier right below him, right below them, just because he has been so effective. And, I mean, look, he's a guy that probably wasn't drafted in a lot of leagues. And if you're in the semifinals or finals, there's a good chance you have Nick Foles on your team, and he wasn't even drafted. So it's been an unusual year. Guys like Nick Foles, Phillip Rivers, to a certain extent, has also he has bounced back after a couple of subpar seasons. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what the top tier and middle tier look like for quarterbacks next season.
Oh, absolutely. And people made a lot of comparisons with Foles to Colin Kaepernick as far as his emergence during the season and being an unheralded guy before that, but not really true from a fantasy perspective because Kaepernick's not in an offense that allows you to do as many things as Foles does. Foles is a little more spectacular on paper as far as that goes. You mentioned about Tom Brady. Yeah, we had him at the top of our second tier this year, I think still number four overall, but it really felt almost un-American in a way to do that. But really, what else could you do going into the season looking at the weapons that he had there? Kendrell Tompkins was thought to be a sleeper, and Gronkowski would be back at some point. But that's going to be one of those things going forward with Brady, is it not? Is that sense of, okay, who's he going to have to throw to? Because, again, Gronkowski going to be a big question mark going into the next year. He, of course, lost Aaron Hernandez for non-football reasons in the offseason. So that's going to be a big thing in the offseason, is it not, in terms of looking to see what the Patriots do, if anything, to shore up that position?
Yeah, and also Danny Amendola. I mean, he was kind of brought in to replace Wes Welker, and he's in and out of the lineup as well. So, Brady, I'm not sure. He's not the first quarterback that should come off the board in a fantasy draft, not the second, not the third, maybe not even the fifth. It really just does depend on what they do as far as other weapons around him. He's not a guy that has thrown the deep ball very well this season. There's a lot of dink and dunk. He's surpassed. He's obviously an excellent quote unquote real life quarterback, but as a fantasy quarterback, I think he has fallen a couple of notches.
Absolutely, and really kind of ashes to ashes, dust to dust, as far as that goes. Because prior to 2007, he really wasn't an elite fantasy quarterback. He was one of the guys like Troy Aikman that was much better in real life than he was. You know, he was kind of a late bloomer statistically when they started getting some of the weapons there. So, yeah, it wouldn't be the first time that happened with him. But also wanted to ask you, as we alluded to in the open, about this new Mid-South DVD that came out recently. Your Legends of Mid-South Wrestling, as we established previously, you were exposed to that when you were growing up. I, unfortunately, wasn't, outside of that brief window of when it was on TBS, and those of us outside of the region could take it in. So I'm just curious what you thought, if you've gotten a chance to see it yet, if you were impressed with it. I thought it was really pretty good. I haven't gotten to check out all the matches, but the documentary features on there really kind of caught my eye. Do you have a thought on the DVD, if you've gotten to see it?
I have not seen it, but it is something that I want to check out. And if I don't go buy it, in and around the holidays, I may check it out. I definitely want to check it out on Netflix. Look, that's kind of what I grew up on. Houston wrestling was huge in its own right, was a huge promotion in its own right. And then once it got under the Mid-South umbrella with Bill Watts, it only made the product better. So that's what I grew up on. It was, in a lot of ways, ahead of its time. And I'm eager to see it, because I want to. I've seen some of the list of matches that are on there, and there's a couple of matches that I actually saw in person. So I'm eager to see those matches and kind of relive those memories.
Yeah, it was really phenomenal as far as the job they did with the production on it and everything. And you had explained a little bit previously, it almost sounded like a unique kind of a circumstance there with Paul Bosch, that he was, I guess, in his later years, sort of more officially affiliated with Bill Watts. But as you had explained previously, Houston Wrestling, that period of time, really was its own kind of entity, and I guess for a long period of time, not simply hitched to one promotion.
Yeah, it was Paul Bosch and Houston Wrestling, like I said, it stood on its own. Every Friday night at the Sam Houston Coliseum in downtown Houston, they would have matches. They would also periodically have big, big events that, kind of quality, pay-per-view quality events, even though back in that day they did not have pay-per-views and things like that. But Paul Bosch ran in his own promotion, was very well respected. And they would have their own stable of stars, and they would occasionally, Ric Flair would have a run, would spend some time in Houston Wrestling. Andre the Giant would then come and have a stint. So they would get superstars and wrestlers from all over the world. They would come to Houston and have a pro, do an angle, have a run, have a series of matches before they moved on. So it was a very different time back then. They had a weekly show on one of the independent stations there in Houston every Saturday morning and every Sunday morning. So for Houstonians, that was appointment viewing in a lot of ways. So it was a different time, but it was a good time.
Absolutely. And again, a lot of the stars, as we indicated, that were on there were a big part of the Mid-South Wrestling promotion, later the UWF, prior to being swallowed up by WCW. And that was, which by the way, that was one of the things, we had Missy Hyatt on the show previously, we talked about that with her. That really was one of the big missed opportunities, was it not? The sense of what they could have done with the UWF invasion in 1987. You bring them in, you just kind of fold them into the promotion there. I mean, you know, picture a situation where, you know, Dusty Rhodes and the Four Horsemen side by side in the War Games against the Invaders. You know, you can't tell me that wouldn't have been monster business.
Well, what I remember about the UWF was, and by then, you know, I think I had, you know, I think my viewing of wrestling had changed a little bit. I didn't watch it as much. But what I remember about the UWF was that's where Sting and the Ultimate Warrior got their start. They were known as the Blade Runners. So they had, Dr. Death, Steve Williams, I believe, was the UWF champion for a while. So it was, you know, there was great stars there, and I know that they tried to, you know, get into bigger arenas and things like that. But, you know, I think you're right. You know, it could have been, it should have been more because all the pieces were there. For whatever reason, it just didn't work out.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, too, and this actually reminds me of one of the things that's on the DVD, because another name that came out of there was the first time we ever heard the name Rick Steiner. I will tell you, on the DVD, Robert, he's not on there as Rick. This must have been his first match, maybe. He is on there as Rob Rex Steiner wrestling against Nick Patrick with Joel Watts and Ric Flair on commentary. So that's one of the things
Wow.
you have to look forward to when you check out the DVD. That is a gem, Robert.
Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. I mean, there are so many, there's so much talent to come out of Mid-South, out of UWF, that it's really kind of remarkable to see all the talent that came out of there in what was, you know, a big promotion, but certainly not anything that was WWE or WCW. You know, in a lot of ways, I miss kind of those smaller promotions, and you know, we do have those now, Ring of Honor, etc. But back then, like I said, it was just a different time, and I do miss those days, though.
Yeah, a lot of magic in the territorial days. Thank God for DVDs and for YouTube and the like, and you can still relive it from time to time. But proving once again now, Robert, when it comes to the pro graphs, college football, bowls, fantasy football, we can have a quality conversation with you about anything. Really, really grateful for your time here today, sir. Thank you for coming back on the show with us. We are very, very glad to get to speak with you about any of these subjects.
Hey, thanks for having me, and you guys have a great holiday season.
Thanks. The very same to you, Robert. We really appreciate it. Thank you all for tuning in, everybody. Mini episode number 361 with Robert Flores.